26 years after his death, President Barack Obama honored Bayard Rustin with the nation's highest civilian award, the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
The day of the March on Washington, the National Mall was far from full, and some in the press were beginning to wonder if the event would be a failure. But the march's chief organizer, Bayard Rustin, didn't panic. As the story goes, he looked down at a piece of paper, looked back up, and reassured reporters that everything was right on schedule. The only thing those reporters didn't know was that the paper he was holding was blank. He didn't know how it was going to work out, but Bayard had an unshakable optimism, nerves of steel, and most importantly, a faith that if the cause is just and people are organized, nothing can stand in our way. So for decades, this great leader, often at Dr. King's side, was denied his rightful place in history because he was openly gay. No medal can change that, but today we honor Bayard Rustin's memory by taking our place in his march towards true equality, no matter who we are or who we love.
Throughout Rustin's life, he was selfless as it pertained to the struggle for equal rights for all people, lending his voice and energy to the advocacy of social justice causes and human rights issues worldwide. Bayard Rustin famously once said that in every community, we need a group of angelic troublemakers, people willing to stand up and speak out against injustice. And he did this to the very
last.
You
are listening to KBOO Portland.
Rev up your support for KBOO Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBOO. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies diverse voices and community perspectives. It's easy and hassle-free. Either visit kboo.fm/cars or call 1-877-KBOO-123. You'll get a tax deduction and the satisfaction of supporting local independent media. Donate your car to KBOO Community Radio today and drive change in your community.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. If you ever want to donate, you can donate by going to KBOO's website and click on the donate button.
Today in the studio with me is... Please introduce yourself and what your role is in the agency you represent.
Sure. Thank you, John. My name is Erin Taylor. I use she, her pronouns. For a visual description, I'm a middle-aged white woman with short brown and gray hair. I wear hexagon rim glasses. I have a hoop in my nose, and I am also wearing a dark blue shirt with a blue background today. So my role at Upstream Access is I'm the executive director for the nonprofit Upstream Access.
And can you tell me a little bit about Upstream Access?
Upstream Access, we really have two robust program areas. One is emergency preparedness and one is social connection. We found that there was a critical area of risk when it came to emergency preparedness and social isolation and loneliness. So we thought, what if we could come together and kind of create programs that work to help us find solutions, programs, community connection, you know, for both of these different topics. So with this, we have developed and delivered different workshops that help foster partnership to create access to emergency preparedness before, during, and after emergencies. And then to address the social isolation and the social connection piece, we have a series of different get-togethers, we have weekly mindfulness sessions, we have outdoor gatherings, we have different events like monthly meetups to eat for eat meals together, have bingo, just to create authentic community and support with the work that we do. Both of these programs also help foster self-advocacy. I would say having a person realize the importance of their voice and the power that it carries, and also the strength that collective voices can bring. So we know that one voice is powerful. We know that more are way more powerful, right? So really bringing the collective voices together. So then also another big part is embracing disability identity and culture. So we're able to do that too. And that helps us to create environments that are more inclusive and welcoming for all to create that sense of belonging.
What kind of community are we talking about?
We're talking about cross-disability community. And when I say that, so a little bit of insight as to my background. I've worked for years with health promotion and other programs for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I myself identify as queer and having non-apparent disabilities. So we realized there was a space that was really important for cross-disability, which means that we don't focus on just one type of disability. We have people with all types, and that's apparent and non-apparent disabilities, because there's a lot of us that have more than one disability. And we know, too, that interdependence and working together is really important. So there's a lot of siloing that can happen within the disability field. So we wanted to kind of open that up and say, we want you to feel like you can come into a space where you belong, however you identify. Really work on not having to check that box to be able to come through. So yes, we are a cross-disability organization. We also have people come to our events who are support workers, active allies. I use the term active allies, not allies. People who may work in the field, because during an emergency, we're all going to have to work together, right? So making sure that that inclusion is really important as we create and build upstream access.
When we talk about cross disabilities, what exactly are we talking about when it comes to that?
Right. That's a really big question, isn't it? I know when people will say, like, what do you mean by disability? And I'm like, I don't know. That's a good question. What is a disability? Right. And so when we're talking about cross disability, we're really talking about anyone who identifies. Doesn't matter age, doesn't matter disability type, doesn't matter whether it's a apparent disability or a non-apparent disability. It's just where people can come together however you identify as disabled. So, we will all either probably more than likely age or acquire a disability at some point in our life. So we may as well just find ways to support each other.
And you, when you say inclusion, you also mean people with different gender identities,
and absolutely,
sexualities, and
yeah, no, it's true, right? So I think of working for years within the disability communities, I think of inclusion as really bringing, like, you can have a building be ADA accessible, and somebody can come into that building, right? That doesn't mean that they feel like they belong or that they are a part of community. So when we're talking about inclusion, how do we foster that space to create where somebody feels like they come into that space, whatever their identities they hold are, and feel like they belong? There's a lot of weight and a lot of beauty and a lot of work with being inclusive too. So with being a cross-disability organization, we have people that will come into space who are deaf or hard of hearing, who are blind, who have spinal cord injuries, who have chronic conditions. So finding ways to create a space where everyone can feel like they can belong and not cause that access friction, it can be tricky, and it's a lot of work, right? But it's really important to be able to work towards that. We never get it done perfect, but we keep trying, and that's what matters.
Yeah, I mean, it's very good never to create boxes or silos, and then you try and quantify everything and everybody. And if you're talking about human beings, you can't really quantify them or stick them all in this group or that group. A lot of them just kind of like cross over here or there. They don't all fit that way or this way. Yeah, there's a lot of variation and difference when you're talking about humans.
disability is complex, right? And so being able to find that way to maybe make it a little less complex. And now I will say, though, that there is an important space for like affinity groups, right? To where people with specific disabilities can come together, right? Like maybe somebody with an intellectual or cognitive disability and they want to group together, or somebody with who are wheelchair users to come together, right? That is important. And yet we know in an emergency, we're all going to have to work together. So that's really for us, coming from where a big part of what we do is emergency preparedness, is really that prep work of accepting ourselves and each other.
Can you give me what brought you to Upstream Access? Can you give us some history, I guess, is what I'm asking for?
Yeah, I can. So that's kind of a fun question to answer, right? It's like, where'd you come from? It's like, so we are just a little under 2 years old. We acquired another nonprofit that was kind of on pause. And so we renamed the nonprofit Upstream Access. There was a group of us working on hosting. We were hosting a bunch of listening sessions around the region to really identify the gaps in emergency preparedness for the cross disability community. So for all types of disability. In these listening sessions, we had people from probably age of early 20s into late 80s with almost 60 different types of disabilities. And with doing this, we really found that there were not just gaps when it came to emergency preparedness, there was really crevices. The gaps were so massive. It's such a huge topic that can be really overwhelming. It's like, where do you even start, right? So when we saw those gaps, we discovered that this was a perfect way to be able to kind of unsilo those groups and just bring people together. And for us, it was just really listening to community members. We listened to what people wanted. We listened to people's fears. We listened to people's concerns, but we also listened to people's strengths, the great ideas that they had, and the creativity. So with that, we were able to really create Upstream Access and a lot of the programming we had. So I also like to think too that with Upstream Access, we kind of take a different approach on disability, not only being cross disability, but also we guide our work on strength-based and not fear-based. So when I say that, what I mean is, like I said, emergency preparedness is such a big topic. Where do you start? We all have strengths though, right? Like you have strengths, I have strengths. And instead of saying what we don't have, we can come from what we do have and build programs off of that. We also do incorporate the disability justice principles, the 10 disability justice principles from Sins Invalid, into the work that we do when it comes to preparedness, response, and recovery. And then also too, when we look at emergency preparedness, we often talk about those worst case scenarios, right? And like I said, we also talk about where people start from, the strengths that you have. So what are your skills? What are your networks? What's your lived experience? And then we can build from there at a personal level and at a group level as well. So we also, there's a couple of philosophies that really go by too. It's like, we really believe that emergency preparedness shouldn't be reduce fear. It should fuel it, right? So our work is never one size fit all. Like we don't hand out just pre-made go bags. We always make things sure that things are personalized, that people have items that are accessible for them, because every plan and every supply list has to be tailored to work for each person in their own environment that they're in, right? So it's really important for us to like say, oh, let's just give all these away, right? It's like, yes, and there are other needs that each person has. And so what are those needs? So
in dealing with emergency preparedness, you also probably have to reach out to like the state or the city or the county. And, you know, like, are you connecting people with those people who will be like during an emergency, this is who you contact mm-hmm. and coordinate with and stuff like that. And then you'd also said something about like an emergency kit. Do you guys make those or how do you make them and how do you fund them?
Yes, we do work with city, county, state level. We work closely with a lot of the different organizations like Oregon Emergency Management. I live in Washington County. We work with Washington County. So we do, for us, part of breaking down that silo, right, that I talk about at the beginning, is not only the disability silo, but it's also government, community, business silos. So really that capitalism, that whole at a higher level, right, of being able to say, if government stays here, if community members stay here, if businesses stay here, then we're going to stay siloed. Right. And so how can we work together? And which is difficult, but through a justice lens, how can we do that through a social justice lens, through a disability justice lens, having government realize like how much value, knowledge, heart as disabled folks we bring to every situation. Right. I mean, you know, John, as like with being disabled, we have to be creative all the time, right? Have to think outside the box, have to find ways, like you said, funding. That's a massive part of what we always, at all of our trainings, we always have resources to give out, because we know that a big barrier and one of those gaps that we saw were finances, right? We heard from people that people wanted trainings, resources, and social connection. So we do not have an event where there is not something to give away. And we also have it to where people get to choose what works for them, because we find it helps with waste as well. If people do not need the items, they can leave them, and then it can be there for somebody else who needs the items. So it's not just like handing a person a bag and then you open the bag and say, I don't know what these are used for. They don't work for me. And then what happens with them? We really work towards personalizing all of the things that we do. With nonprofits, often there's, because of funding, the scarcity model, right? Of like, and so we really want to kind of fight against it a little bit to be able to give those resources out and find ways. So whether it's asking if people want to donate items, we do a lot of work with solar powered items. We've given out over 300 different kinds of solar powered items to people. We do that in some of our programming. For us, this is really important, because when power goes out, what do people have to use for the medical and communication devices? So, so both of those are a couple of different ways that we work on breaking down the silos, working with governments and nonprofits and companies, and then also to like financially, like you said, it's expensive, right? We've even done a presentation on how to build your kit at the Dollar Tree. We've done a presentation on that, because it's at least a way you can go to Dollar Tree and just get 5 items and just start building your kit. And we talk a lot about just starting small, getting one item at a time, right? So it's not so overwhelming.
Yeah, and I thought maybe you also did things through like people's ABLE accounts or their special needs trust, you know, start saving up money with this resource, and this will enable you to purchase this emergency piece of your kit when you need it, or something like that. You know, I was just,
I think it's always good to think of the different ways that you can save, right? Especially as we know that there's so many people that can only keep so much money in their account that they can only, right? And that's a whole nother topic for another day, right? The frustrations of that and the autonomy and agency of a person. But there's so many different ways, and part of what we hope to do is make it to where it's not so overwhelming for the person to have to, for a person to have to think about that on their own, right? We can do that together.
All right. And I was just kind of curious, do you run this organization all alone, or do you have helpers?
I have helpers. we're fortunate enough to have a couple staff that work a few hours a week. We have contractors too, who are able to, whether it's presenting for our different topics, whether it's helping with evaluation. And then we also have a whole bunch of volunteers too, of people that just want to get involved. So oftentimes when it comes to someone who wants to volunteer, is finding out what works for them and what they want, right? It's really important for us to, like, we want this to become fun, not a chore for people. And we think it's fun, but we want, that's our biggest thing, is if we can have people realize like, preparing does not have to be scary, and it does not have to be sad, and it does not have to be lonely, that we can make it fun and done together. So it is not just me, there's a group of us out there, and we have support. We partner with a lot of other organizations. It was really important when we started that it wasn't like, we're coming in to do this. It's like, how can we do this collectively with other groups and stuff too? So that's really important for us.
And even though you said you're mostly out in Washington County, do you still operate in Clackamas and Washington County, or do you operate all over the state?
We're statewide in Southwest Washington. So another part of breaking down the silos, right, is there's just a bridge that separates, but all of our experiences with, as far as like natural disasters and stuff, are very similar. So we may be invited to some place to host a workshop. An example is we are coming into a space to host mental health resilience kit workshop. So that's an example of, we realize like we talk a lot about comfort items when we build emergency kits. So we often talk about food, water, shelter, but we don't talk about those items that bring us comfort, that help calm us. So what we've done is we've created a program where we have 8 different stations and we have different themes, and they have different kinds of fidgets or journaling, different items for people, decks of cards, maybe different games, and that people can get an item from each section, and then they get to put it in a bag to put it in their emergency bag. And then they have a mental health resilience kit in their emergency bag. And then we also can talk about stress management. We can talk about different breathing and mindfulness, meditation. So that's an example of a workshop that will come in. Or we'll do a workshop on extreme heat. Part, again, of breaking down the silo is tailoring it to the community that we're working with, right? And when I say community, that might be whether it is maybe it's assisted living for older adults, right? Or maybe it is a tabling event at a city event.
So I've always wondered, when it comes to an emergency kit, some of the things that a person could use or need or want might, like, to, let's just say somebody would like a gun. I'm wondering if this has ever made you uncomfortable. Has there ever been a request in an emergency kit or a particular item within an emergency kit that's made you a little uncomfortable about?
Yeah, so let me think about this for a second. I mean, this is gun control, right? Is a very big topic anyway right now. For us, it's really important not to gatekeep what people have in their kits, but what do they feel like they need to have or is important for them, right? So we don't necessarily come in and say yes, no, don't have this, do have this. It's really up to a person and what a person needs to do for their own autonomy, agency, safety. So, we've had questions about gun safety and how do we feel about it, right? And that's a very personal topic for each person to have. But I take the stance that a person needs to personalize their kit that works for them to help them feel like they will be able to, you know, be supported in the way that they need to in the emergency that they may be facing. Another way that we do that is we are the first people in the United States to pilot a curriculum from Australia called PCEP, which is Person-Centered Emergency Preparedness. And that's what this really does, is it's called the capability wheel, and it has 8 parts of this wheel. And we're able to sit down with a person and just like you and I, just like we're having this conversation now, that's what we'd be able to do with PCEP, and really being able to be like, let's pull out assistive technology and talk about that. Let's pull about living situation. So maybe that question about guns would come up with the living situation, right? Like, if you have one in your house, is it safe? Like, do you have it locked up? Do you know how to use it? You know, that type of situation. But being able to bring this curriculum and pilot it helps us really take it from where we've done these group trainings and resource sessions that we have, workshops, having this curriculum comes and helps us be able to personalize it and do it one-on-one planning, which is really important because most people do not have a plan, have go bags that are personalized in the way that they need to. We're able to have people take this training online through Australia. It's asynchronous, and it's 6 modules in 5 weeks. So asynchronous means you can do it online whatever hours you want. So if you wake up at 2 in the morning and that's when you learn the best, then that's what works for you. So we're doing 5 cohorts of that to bring it over to Oregon, since we are the first people to do that, which is really exciting. There's a national organization called the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, And they are also a cross-disability national group that helps with emergency preparedness, response, recovery. And we're going to be partnering with them in October, November, and December. So we're going to have a community storytelling series called Our Preparedness, Our Power: Stories of Individual and Collective Resilience. This is going to be over Zoom. We're going to have it in English, Spanish, and ASL. And so the first session is Pathways to Survival, The Right to Get Out. That one really is access in evacuation is survival, right? So really talking about what those barriers are when it comes to evacuating, how we can reframe evacuation as a human right, and to make sure that inclusive planning happens. The second one in November is going to be Rooted at Home, Shelter, Safety, and Community Care. That one really is about how preparedness is collective and rooted in relationships. So how do we build those social connections to help us when it comes to sheltering in place or getting ready for preparedness? And this one really is going to have lots of stories on collective resilience and what that looks like. And then the third one is Charge for Survival, Disability Stories of Tech and Power. So we say access to power equals access to life. This one is really going to be about how electricity and power is survival for people, and how outages risk health and communication, and how electricity really is a lifeline for so many disabled folks. So as we become more independent with technology, we need more resources for that backup power and to be able to know how to use a backup power. So not just to be given a backup battery or generator, but how do you actually use it? So we're going to have those once a month in October, November, December. All of these items that I've mentioned today, you can find on our website under our events page. So it's www.upstreamaccess.org. You can sign up for our newsletter. You can sign up for any of our events, attend any of them. We also have, we're on Facebook under Upstream Access, and we're on Instagram under upstream.access. And we also have a monthly newsletter that we send out to people. We're starting a new membership to where people can join to become free members. And this way they will be able to receive alert and warning messages when we receive them from like the state or different areas. It will also allow to find out how people can find out about paid opportunities, because we'll sometimes have listening sessions and or other opportunities. And it's really important. We say that if anybody shares their lived experience, they should be paid. So compensation is a big part of what we really advocate for. And then also too, so people as members, they'll be able to find first when there's trainings and workshops or different maybe free items that we give out. So there's a lot of different ways that you can find out about us, learn about us, come join us, follow us, be a part of community, right? Because our tagline is celebrate disability and community resilience and a collective resilience. Celebrate community and collective resilience. And that collective resilience takes everyone, non-disabled people and disabled folks, right? And so it's really important that we open up this opportunity for people to be a member so that we can, when there is messaging that has to get out quickly, we can have set people that we send it out to.
Thank you so much for doing this. You know, thank you for coming in and doing this interview with me. For coming in and telling us about Upstream Access.
John, thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
tuned to KBOO Portland.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots from energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the evening news, weekdays at 5 p.m. here on 90.